to be week 18 of Megillat Esther. Just today is March 2nd. I believe we are scheduled to have class on the 9th and the 16th before we take our Pesach break. So we'll get in 2 weeks of Rut before Pesach. I don't know yet how many weeks we'll be learning Ruth. Ballpark 8 or 9, but honestly, I don't know yet. Too early to tell. I'm still not entirely sure which questions and problems I want to address in it, so we'll see. But we are, at this point, in Perek Tet in Chapter 9. And there's one question I want to deal with in Chapter 9, which I've been holding since the very beginning. I know Susan's been waiting for this. And then also two questions I want to address in Chapter 10. The series for the year is dedicated by Dana and Ilan Rubinstein. Thank you. And I'd like to dedicate learning today for Refuah Shlema, a speedy and complete recovery for Yehudit Bat Simcha Nachma. Okay. So the question that we wanted to address in Chapter 9, we had a good time with Chapter 9 last time. I really enjoyed what we did there in terms of the Mishloach Manot and in terms of the war. But the question still is authorship. Who wrote this book? And the easy answer is, I don't know. But we have a lot of information. The problem is that it's conflicting. That's really the challenge. Professor Gavriel Chaim Cohn, I think he's rabbi professor, was a professor of Tanakh at Bar-Ilan. I think he might even still be professor of Tanakh at Bar-Ilan. I should be careful about my wases. He was also actually, though, I think the head of Machon Gold, for those who remember that school in Israel. He wrote the introduction to Esther in the Dat Mikra edition. And he makes the argument that from the book of Esther itself, it's clear that it was written in the time of the Persian Empire. There's a lot of familiarity with court life in Persia. There is a heavy content of Persian words that make it into the Megillah. This isn't something being written down centuries later to capture an old story. At the same time, I said, the evidence is conflicting. When you look at the other books that we have from the early second Beis HaMikdash, second Temple period, Ezra and Nehemiah, obviously, being leaders in that regard, there's no mention of the story, and there's no mention of this book. You know, why is that? Why, you know, if it was written then, you don't have enough information to draw conclusive arguments. There also isn't really useful evidence from the text itself. There are passages about writing something, but is that the book of Esther? So I call your attention to the first source on the sheet, where I gave you references to Chapter 9. We're going to look at the psukim, we're look at the sentences ourselves, and see whether you can draw any conclusions about who wrote this book of Esther. Take a look at Chapter 9, sentence 20. This is the part of Chapter 9 that I discussed very briefly and then gave you a couple of articles about, where Mordechai and then Esther and Mordechai write scrolls that they send around regarding the observances of Purim then and in the future. So in Chapter 9, sentence 20, we get Mordechai's book, or Mordechai's letter, I should say. Vayichtov Mordechai es hadvarim ha'ele. Mordechai wrote these things. Okay. These things presumably refers to what we saw in the previous sentence about the celebrations for Purim. Vayishlach sefarim kol ha'yehudim asher b'chol medinos ha'melech Achashverosh. He sends letters to all the Jews throughout all the lands of Achashverosh, ha'karovim v'harachokim, near and far, and it continues, l'kayem aleihem li'os osim es yom arba asar l'chodesh adar, yom chamisha asar, to observe the 14th and 15th days of Adar annually, not just this year, but going forward. And that's the way the text continues into sentence 22. Mordechai writes a letter that says we should be observing Purim. Does it sound like Mordechai wrote Megillat Esther? No, right? I mean, I see head shaking. No, I do know how to use polls now, so I can poll everybody. But I think we're a small enough group. You know, we can pretty much manage without the toys.
Do you know in what language did you write?
I'm sorry?
Do you know in what language did you write?
So here the text doesn't say, meaning in many, many of the letters that are written in Megillat Esther, it says in the language of each nation. Here it doesn't actually say. We're not told that. So it seems relatively clear. The first letter is not the book of Esther. Now you go to the end of the chapter, sentence 29, and we get a second letter. Vatichtov Esther Malka bat Avichayil u Mordechai haYehudi. Esther and Mordechai wrote. They wrote as one, apparently, because the word is vatichtov, which is a singular verb. That's not so unusual. We find that elsewhere. Think of Devorah's poem, Vatorah uBarak ben Avinoam. Singular verb. And Devorah sang, and Barak ben Avinoam. He had some kind of role. What it was is a separate shiur. But the point here is, Esther wrote, and Mordechai, all of the tokef, the authority, L'kayem es igeres haprim azos hasheni, to uphold this second scroll about Purim. Okay, I'm just going to mute everybody because I'm getting background noise from someone. There we go. And the text continues to say they sent scrolls out throughout the land for them to fulfill these days of Purim as established by Mordechai and Esther, and give us a little bit of the story, how they had fasted, how they had cried out to God. Does that sound like it is the book of Esther? Right. What makes it more likely? Jeanette, your sound is low. That's all right. I just feel bad because people tell me when they listen to the recordings, they can't always make out everybody's voices. So I want to make sure you're audible.
Is that better or not?
Not so much. But anyway, you were saying. Sorry. It really doesn't, I mean, to me, there's more of a record, but it doesn't sound like they wrote the entire story. Well, interestingly, the Talmud and the commentators go in opposite directions on the issue of authorship and how to read these sentences. That's not so strange. Meaning, I see your hand, Susan. That's not so strange. Those who are learning Shmuel with me, in the Thursday Shmuel Shir, have seen that a couple of times. You may recall in Shmuel chapter 8, where Shmuel talks about appointing a king, and he lists the powers that a king has, the view in the Gemara is that Shmuel is telling them about legitimate powers that the kings have. There's a debate in the Gemara, and that's the conclusion that we draw from it, that these are real powers, whereas the commentators on the biblical text, they know Shmuel is trying to intimidate them, saying, you know, you're going to appoint a king over yourself, your kings are going to do terrible things. So, different approach. The Talmud is saying one thing, and the commentators to the text are saying something different. Or, as another example, we just learned this in recent weeks in that Shmuel class, when you look at the marriage or apparent marriage of King David to first Merav, daughter of Shaul, and then Michal, daughter of Shaul, the sages in the Talmud seem to think that there actually was a marriage of some form between David and Merav. And the commentators to the biblical text say, no, there was no marriage. They never got married. David didn't want to marry Merav. And then that was it. She married Adriel, and David went on and married Michal. So you have cases in which the Talmud says one thing about a story in Tanakh, and the commentators to the text go a different route. And that, interestingly, is what seems to happen here, where the Talmud is going to say that the text is actually authored by the Great Assembly, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, and the commentators to the Book of Esther insist, no, some combination of Esther and Mordechai wrote the text. And we're going to go through the sources now to show that. But Susan, you've been waiting very patiently. What were you going to say?
We had read some commentary that said the Greeks
had a similar story to our story of Esther at the same time in their literature.
Interesting. I'd love to see that. If you could send that to me, I would love to see that because I'm not familiar.
I'll find it. Okay. But also, I just wanted to tell you, I don't know if you know, if you remember, you had a student named Margaret Weinstein.
Yeah.
Our age. She just passed away.
Oh.
So.
I'm very sorry to hear that.
Yeah. I don't know her.
Okay. Thank you. I'll follow up afterwards. But.
I just thought you'd want to know.
Yeah. Thank you. So, the Gemara on the one hand, and the commentators on the other hand, go in different directions here. Take a look, please, at source number 2. Classic Gemara in Bava Basra. The Gemara in Bava Basra that we're talking about here in context is dealing with partnerships. What happens if multiple parties own something, and then one of them wants to split the partnership? And the question then is, can you demand that there be a split? And part of it is, well, what is each party going to end up with? Will they end up with something useful? So one of the discussions there is, what if they own scrolls of Tanakh? Can one party say, I want to split, and I'm going to take some of the books and you'll take some of the books? And that leads into a discussion about the unity of Tanakh and who wrote each book in Tanakh. So that's where we're going with this. Can everyone still hear me? Some of you seem frozen. We're good? Okay. So the Talmud here in source number 2 informs us, the Anshe Knesset HaGedola, the great assembly of sages who lead the Jews in the initial generations of the Second Temple, they wrote the book of Yechezkel, as well as Shneimasar, Treyasar, the 12 small books of prophecies that are in the end of Nevi'im, as well as Daniel, and the book of Esther. So Daniel did not write his own book. Yechezkel did not write his own book. The Anshe Knesset HaGedola, the great assembly, wrote those, as well as all of those other books in Treyasar. Think of Yonah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. All of these are actually authored by the great assembly. And the Gemara goes through how you know that. It's not, you know, a statement in a vacuum. There's a discussion there. Yes, Susan. Some of them, and some of them.
When was the period that they wrote?
The first generations of the Second Temple period. So for some of them, it's contemporary, meaning it's contemporary to Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi are involved with the Great Assembly. But on the other hand, some of the other prophets that we're talking about, Treyasar includes Hoshea, who's long gone by the time you get to that. So Yechezkel is around and prophesying in the period between the two temples. He does not make it to the Second Temple. But he wouldn't have been that long before then. Yeah, Rebecca.
I'm just wondering why we're ascertaining this. In that, I mean, I don't know. I will speak for myself. I hope not considered public courses. I wouldn't consider this history. I mean, I would say, why do we were trying to understand who wrote it to sort of, that it enhances our, you know, what... ourselves as Jews and stuff, but I mean, would you consider this historical what we're reading in the Talmud?
So,
for me, it doesn't feel that way, and I'm trying to understand why it makes a difference who wrote it.
So, I'll say two things. Three things, actually. First, I'm not sure what this is that you're referring to, meaning, are you asking whether we view it as historical when the Talmud says who wrote it, or the book itself? No, but which one are you asking about now? Because the
historical in terms of who wrote it. I mean, I find that hard to.
Why?
You know, I mean, I would just say that these are people who felt the need to have this kind of story as part of our canon, more than that they a checklist and a door, you know, are writing history.
On what basis? Like, meaning we can do pretty well in determining the era when this was written. Professor Cohn's comment, which I don't know if you were on yet when I quoted it, that the text itself reflects a strong knowledge of the Persian court, already gives us a certain era for this to be written in. And the fact that it's accepted as part of the canon and not subject to debate suggests that it is written by authoritative figures. Like, I have no problem with the historicity of the statement that the Great Assembly would have written it. I'm good with that. But in terms of the question of why we're asking this for two reasons. Number one, because Susan really wanted to know, and so I had to make sure that we were going to get to it. But number two, because, as we're going to see, it does matter who we credit. It affects how we look at the book. So you'll see what I mean as we go through it.
I'm familiar. I mean, I know. Kitsuri was there, but that isn't... No,
that's not what I'm talking about.
Oh.
Hang in there. Although that source is coming up in source number three, but it's not, that's not where I'm going with it. So the Talmud here thinks it's the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the Great Assembly, that they write in general the Sifrei Galut, the books of exile. So they write the book of Daniel about Jews in exile. They write Yechezkel, a prophet in exile. And they write Esther about Jews in exile, right? We've talked about this being the book of exile. So it makes sense. They're putting them all together. In source number three, I show you a Gemara in Megillah, which is the one that Rebecca just referenced, in which Esther requests canonization, and ultimately the decision is made to canonize it by this great assembly, unclear about the writing of it. But take a look at number three. Shalchalahem Esther lachachamim. Esther sent a message to the sages. Kitvuni l'darot, record me for generations. I want this recorded for all time. And they said to her, sorry, too late. Halo katavti lachashalishim. We have a text in Mishlei, in Proverbs, which says, have I not recorded for you shalishim? And they take this in a non-literal way, shalishim, like three, v'lo ribeim, and not four, which the Talmud understands to mean, and how they get to this is a great discussion, but it's beyond the scope of what we're going to get to right now, but they get the idea that there can only be three records of the war with Amalek in Tanakh, and not four. So therefore, we can't write another war with Amalek. And then they said, no, not so fast. Go back to the Torah, the first war with Amalek, and there we find the verse, K'tov Zod Zikaron Basefer, record this as a memorial in a book, and they deduce from there, as you see in the Gemara here in source number three, K'tov Zot, record this, means the account in the Torah in Shemot, the book of Shemot, and the account in the book of Devarim, meaning Parashat Kitetze. Then Zikaron is the references to the war with Amalek in the prophets, and Basefer is Megillat Esther, which is in the Ketuvim, in the writings. So they come up with a justification for including it. That doesn't really speak to who wrote the scroll. It speaks to the decision of canonizing it. So that would be a fair point. But the general idea is that the hand of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah of the Great Assembly is involved. However, as I said to you before, the commentators to the text surprisingly go a different route. Take a look at Rashi in source number four. On the first verse we read that Mordechai wrote a letter and sent it around saying, hey guys, observe Purim. Vayichtov Mordechai, and Mordechai wrote, Hi hamagilah hazot kimot shehi. He's not unclear, right? Rashi is really clear. This is Megillat Esther. Mordechai is the one who wrote it. Ibn Ezra also says Mordechai wrote it, unclear about Esther's role. Take a look at source number five. This is a well-known comment by Ibn Ezra. We discussed it in the early going in this series. The idea that Hashem's name does not appear in Megillat Esther, and we talked about why that is. Well, the Ibn Ezra, in his commentary to it, says, I'll tell you why God's name is not there. And along the way, he mentions authorship. He says, V'anachon be'enai. You know what appears good in my eyes? Shezot ha-Megillah chibra Mordechai. He first dismisses the idea that mimakom acher in chapter 4 is a reference to God. He first says that's not true. But then he says, Mordechai composes the Megillah. V'zeh tam v'yishlach sfarim. And that's what it means when it says, and he sent scrolls. And then he goes on to say that the Persians copied this into their chronicles of their kings. And the Persians were idolatrous. And therefore, if Mordechai were to include the name of God, when they copied it over, they would use the name of their God. And we don't want that. So therefore, Mordechai doesn't mention God in the Megillah. Leave aside the mentioning of God's name and that piece of it. Although we do find that. We are familiar with that idea that texts that were written in different cultures, you just penciled in the name of your God instead of the name of somebody else's God. That's not news. But my point in bringing it is that he says, yeah, Mordechai did. Vayishlach svarim, just like the text says, and he sends scrolls. The truth of the matter is that the text and he sends scrolls appears twice in chapter 9. It appears once for Mordechai's scroll and once for the scroll that Esther wrote. So I don't know which one he's referring to. But the point is, once again, no mention of the great assembly. It's Mordechai and Esther who wrote it, says Ibn Ezra. It's not just the early commentators, Rashi and Ibn Ezra. It's Malbim also. Take a look at source number 6. Malbim says it's Mordechai and Esther. Malbim is trying to solve a problem. Malbim is always trying to solve a problem. Malbim likes the problems and he likes his answers. So the problem that he's trying to solve here is what we pointed to last week, which is, why did you have two sets of scrolls go out telling people to observe Purim? Why did you need to have a scroll in sentence 20 and then another scroll in sentence 29? So this is Malbim's approach. He says in source number 6, Esther ratzta shamigilah zo tisha'er bein haketuvim. Esther wanted this scroll to remain among the writings. But there was a debate among the sages. You're not supposed to add to the existing scrolls. He can't be referring to source number 3 because that was a different debate. Nonetheless, that's what he says. And he says that's in the Gemara and Megillah. I think that what he's referring to is unclear to me. But he says there's a debate. You can't add. There was also an argument about accepting these days, meaning the Purim celebrations, as law. Shovrim al bal tosif, you're adding to the Torah if you create a new holiday. So Esther needed to join with Mordechai. V'katva betokef hamalchut asher biyada. She used her royal authority. L'kayem et igeret haprim hazot hashinit hu kiyum ha'igeret be'atzmo. In order to uphold this scroll, to uphold Purim, and al pi mamarei Esther eile b'ta'anotea shekadva chachmei ador ahu nitkayem divrei haprim ha'eile hiskimu eile lachzik ba'purim l'asa tochok olam. Because of her authority as the queen, Purim ends up being upheld, and they enshrine the writings in our canon. So as far as he's concerned, there's a first letter, the Chachamim resist, and there's a second letter in which Esther joins in as queen, and at that point everything becomes accepted in Judaism. So that's the idea. The point for us, once again, is that the Malbim is agreeing with Rashi, with Ibn Ezra. These scrolls are recorded by Mordechai and Esther. There is actually a Gemara that they can use to support their view. Gemara is a big place. Sometimes they'll say one thing, sometimes it'll say something that disagrees. Take a look at source number 7. We write the Megillah, as hopefully we are by now aware since we celebrated last week, in a proper scroll, right? With kosher ink, the whole bit. The Gemara asks, how do you know you're supposed to do that? Mishnah says, it's in source number 7, the Mishnah says, Al HaSefer, in a scroll, Ubidio, and with the special ink that we use. Minolam, the Gemara wants to know, how do you know that that's the way you're supposed to write the Megillah? Well, Asya Ksiva Ksiva. The answer is, we have a pleonasm. I deliberately brought this just so I could say the word pleonasm, because it's a fun word. I learned that word from Rabbi Bleich's writings. Anybody know what a pleonasm is? Sorry, Rebecca? Two nazims. Two nazims is a pleonasm. A pleonasm is what we call a gzera shava. A gzera shava means when you have an unusual word that is used in the Torah in two different contexts, and we link them and say there's something that's meant to be learned by bridging these two areas. So that's a pleonasm. So here it says, Vatichtov Esther Hamalka, Esther wrote, and also the word kaf taf bet, for writing, is used in Yirmiyahu. When Baruch ben Neriah transcribes something that Yirmiyahu tells him, and he says specifically, I recorded them, kotev, al ha-sefer, on a scroll with this special ink, with dio, and that's how we understand how you write the Megillah. My point here is not so much to discuss why these writings are the ones that are merged. The word lichtov shows up an awful lot in the Torah. Are we going to say that every time you use the word kotev, now it has to be written in this way? Maybe. But the point that I'm bringing is simply that we are deducing the laws for writing Megillat Esther from the verse Vatichtov Esther Hamalka, and Esther wrote. So you have to be thinking she wrote the Megillah. Otherwise, why does that teach me anything about writing Megillat Esther? So you do have a Gemara that supports this. But my point here is, you could support either side. You have a Gemara saying explicitly, Anshe Knesset Agdola, the Great Assembly. And then you have all these commentators who are saying, Esther and Mordechai, some combination thereof. So what I want to get to here, and I see your hand, Moish, but I'm going to go through this first, please. What I want to get to here is this. Why would the Gemara have assumed that Esther and Mordechai did not write it? And this comes back to your question, Rebecca, about why this question matters. What's the motivation to take Mordechai and Esther out of the writing? Don't tell me it's a knock on Esther, because you took out Mordechai also, number one. And number two, the scroll itself gives Esther prominent credit for basically everything else. So it's inadequate to say it's a knock on Esther. That I don't buy. So why is the Gemara not crediting them with it? Chana?
I think possibly a knock on both of them.
Then again, why are you playing them up in the book?
Possibly that they are putting themselves front and center, and maybe that's not an appropriate thing for someone to do, that there isn't God's name, and that it could be misconstrued.
Right. So, Chana, hold on one second. I just want to expand on that. Sorry. The one possibility is that this is sort of valedictory autobiography. Right? Look at the cool thing we did. I'm going to come back to that, because I think that's a very strong idea here. Chana, you were going to say?
The first class we had, you said, because it says by the Ahasuerus, it has to be later on.
Right.
Because they hated the time of Ahasuerus.
Right. So going back to what we had said in the beginning today, even though we say that there is clear familiarity with the Persian Empire, nonetheless, you can make the argument against. And one of the arguments against is what we said in week one, as Chana remembers, that the text says, and it was in the days of Ahasuerus, sounds like it's being written later. And to add to that, we went through the text in chapter 9 and said the text really doesn't sound like it's saying that they wrote it. It sounds like it's saying that they wrote other things, other scrolls. So the text doesn't really say in any clear way that they wrote it, which is an important point. Moish, you're muted.
I'd like to offer something a little bit different.
One second. Is it on this point or is it on a separate point?
Yeah.
Okay.
Once it says there was more than one draft, shall we say, that opens the door to there being many drafts. And I think what happened here is that Mordechai and Esther together or separately wrote the first one with a very strong view to how does the emperor like it. They sent that in to the Anshei Knesset Agdolah. Anshei Knesset Agdolah said, whoa, we've got to change all these things. Take it back to the emperor. That probably went through a few times, till there was either two drafts or there was one that actually was acceptable by everyone.
Mm-hmm. So it's a nice idea. I would like evidence, but it's a nice idea. I mean, it plays into the role that Mordechai plays within the kingdom and that Esther plays within the kingdom. And even Ezra's feelings about, you know, the fact that this is going to make it to the Persian Chronicles. So I definitely hear the idea. I hear what you're saying.
Let me make one more point on that, which is that look at the Megillah through the eyes of Chazal, the rabbis of the Talmud. But if you don't look at that for a second, and you just look at it as somebody from the Persian Empire, it's a beautiful story for Ahasuerus. If you look at it his way, it's a really great positive story for him.
I mean, if you don't mind being portrayed as being drunken, a little angry, you know, got some anger management issues.
So he gets drunk once. He gets angry once.
Once. Mega 6-month party plus an additional week because 6 months wasn't, like, come on.
No, but that's what I said. If you don't take the Chazal approach, which Chazal demean all kings.
No, they don't. There are kings they do not demean, but this is a bigger discussion that we have to have separately.
Right.
Ricky. Yeah. Ricky, I think you, were you raising your hand or were you giving the thumbs up?
No, I was raising my hand. My Tanakh has a big tough in Vatikhtov.
Yes.
What's the meaning of that?
Yeah, I don't know. There is a big tough in Vatikhtov and the answer is I don't know. It's a good question though. So, I want to come back to Rebecca's point. I have three ideas for why it matters and why the Gemara would assume that it's not Mordechai and Esther. My first approach is simply textual evidence, along the lines of what Chana was saying. But my second approach is this issue of valedictory autobiography, because we really don't like that in the Gemara. I brought you, as an example of this, source number 8. Those of you who learned Shoftim with me may recall that there are two verses that come near each other in Shoftim, in Judges chapter 5. In chapter 5, I think it's sentence 6 or 7, Devorah says, things were terrible, ad shakamti Devorah, shakamti em b'Yisrael, until I arose, Deborah, until I arose as a mother in Israel. And then, a few sentences later, I think it's sentence 12, she says, Uri, Uri, Devorah, Uri, Uri, Dabri Shir, wake up, Devorah, speak your poem. In the middle of her poem, she says it. So look what the Gemara does with that in source number 8. Hebrews at the bottom of one side, English at the top of the next side. The Gemara says, first of all, Im chacham hu chochmaso mistalekes mimenu, mei hillel. It's talking about arrogance. And it says, if somebody is arrogant and they are a sage, they will lose their wisdom. And there's a story there involving Hillel and actually this year's calendar with Erev Pesach being Shabbos, but it's another discussion. Im Navihu, if the person is a prophet, Mistalekes Mimenu, if you become arrogant, you lose your prophecy, Dichsiv. Because the text says, Devorah says, things were terrible and then I arose, Devorah. It is. Pasuk Zayin and Pasuk Yud Beis. And then it says, wake up, Devorah. Meaning, in midway through her poem, she loses her prophetic ability because she was self-congratulatory. But lest you say, hey, we're picking on women because we don't like Devorah being self-congratulatory, the same thing comes up with Nehemiah. In Nehemiah, in a couple of places, he takes credit for his achievements. In chapter 5, he does it, and then again in chapter 13. And take a look at source number 9, where the Gemara in Sanhedrin deals with this. Some of you may remember from when we learned Ezra and Nehemiah sometime back. The Gemara is bothered. Why is it that we don't have a book named Nehemiah? Now, some of you look at me and say, what do you mean we don't have a book named Nehemiah? Of course we have a book named Nehemiah, but we don't. We have divided up the book of Ezra into Ezra and Nehemiah. But in the days of the Gemara, and as late as Rashi, it was called the book of Ezra. It was one big book. It was the book of Ezra. As a matter of fact, well, let me tell you the matter of fact thing after we see source number 9. The Gemara asks, Michti komili de Ezra. Nechemya ben Chakalya amrinhu. All of the things Ezra did, were actually recorded by Nechemya. Ezra, the Sofer, did not write his own book. Nechemya wrote it. Unechemya ben Chakalya, my time alo ikri sifra al shmei. So I don't understand. Why isn't the book named for him? This should just be a book of Nechemya. Amar Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Abba, to which Rabbi Yirmiyah bar Abba said, I'll tell you why. Mibnei shehechzik tova la'atzmo, because he congratulated himself. Shenemar, as the text says, Zochra li Elokai letova kol asher asisi ala amazeh. God, remember me for the good, all that I did for this nation. And Rabbi Yosef goes even further. Rabbi Yosef Amar Mibnei shesiper begnusan shel rishaim. Because he degraded those who came before him. When he talked about how those who came before him burdened the nation too much, and they took this and they took that for themselves. And he was even talking about Daniel. So the idea is self-congratulation is not really acceptable. Parenthetically, hang on, Susan. The Chidah writes that this was corrected, that the reason why we end up with a separate book of Nehemiah is because at a certain point it was judged that he had achieved his atonement, and therefore now he gets to have a book under his name. There's more to be said about this and Nehemiah's reasons for being self-congratulatory. He had a lot of people who didn't like him, and so it's suggested that maybe he had to do this, that he wrote the book essentially as a defense for his activities. But my point here is this. It's possible to argue that what the Gemara is doing is taking authorship away, saying Esther and Mordechai would not have written this book that describes them in such wonderful terms. It was somebody else who said it about them. Better to have somebody else praise you than praise yourself. Yes, Susan.
Didn't people name their own books? What you're saying is that Ezra and Nehemiah never, the book got named when it was canonized?
Yeah, you don't name your book. You don't get to name your book.
All our books after the Torah, or even in the Torah, yeah, are named by the rabbis later?
Names are a utility handle. They're not a, it's not like the book ever says in it, here's the name of the book. Those who use it. That's what I would, when people have to refer to it, you need a name. So here's the name. That's my understanding. Rebecca.
Because I only have Hanukkah and Tepurim as being both related holidays. So Hanukkah didn't get cast. Was it because it was too late?
Hanukkah is too late. Sorry. Guys, hello. Susan? My internet connection is weak right now. That's the message I'm getting. So I'm trying to avoid overburdening it. But I will tell you that, yes, Hanukkah is too late by far. Rebecca.
I just, for whatever it's worth, we'll just add sort of this whole conversation where Esther is, whether she wrote it, but even the conversation she has with the Chachamim, I will say that especially as a young woman learning this, the conversation of Kitru Nudorot, the fact that Kimu the Kibru, all of these things in Esther, I think as a young woman were very possibly empowering, we might say. I just thought I would add to this in that there's so much effort to sometimes make things either prohibit or to not exclude and to minimize women's roles. And I have to say, as a young woman, this was a very powerful, these conversations between the Chachamim and Esther and the role she might have played in writing it and the role she played in the Halacha conversation was a very powerful one.
I hear you.
I just thought I would add that.
Yeah, thank you. I definitely hear it. Obviously, it's not something I can relate to directly. I appreciate the perspective. The other point, though, that I would make in terms of who wrote it and why it matters is because when you ascribe it to Mordechai and Esther, they're writing the book in order to encourage everybody to commemorate Purim, right? And that's very clear. If you read that text in chapter 9, the book is a means to enshrining Purim in national memory. L'kayem et yimei HaPurim ha'ela. That's what they're trying to do. However, if it's the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, what's the goal of writing it? If it's the Great Assembly, what's the goal? It's not about Purim anymore.
But then it's about when we began with the idea of the community in exile.
Yes.
No.
You're right. It's a much broader religious theme and message. It is, as Rebecca notes, about the nation in exile. It also connects it with the rest of Tanakh. If Mordechai and Esther write it, it's a book in a vacuum. If the Anshei Knesset HaGedola write it, then we look at this as part of a greater framework with a broader message. And I think, to me, that may be what the Gemara is doing by crediting it to the Anshei Knesset HaGedola, is it's saying, this isn't Mordechai and Esther saying, remember what happened with us. This is the voice of Tanakh as a whole, and a piece of a bigger picture, and that to me is why this question of authorship matters. Yeah, Chana.
I think also the timing of it's the beginning of a very long dialogue. So the Czechoslovaks saw it coming, and before that there was no need maybe so much to talk to the Jews of the diaspora, but now there are a lot of Jews of the diaspora for the next who knows how many years. I think it's very timely.
So it could be, except that the Great Assembly is around, 400 years before they're going to go back into Galut. I mean, you could argue that there's a Galut experience of sorts already under the Greeks, but still,
yes.
At this point, they don't know that. Janine?
Just the reverse way of looking at it, you had asked why they were hesitant to mention it, and I think this is one of the few stories that took place entirely in Galut. I mean, I was thinking about Eeyore. I don't know where that took place, but it was immaterial. Where it took place was really philosophical rather than...
Correct. It may not have been on Earth at all.
Right. While this one is kind of a little out of the box, because everything else takes place mainly in the land of Israel, or having to do with leaving it or coming back, but it's not... The whole thing happens.
Right. No, and that was one of our Book of Exile points, that when we labeled it, that was that this is about being Jews elsewhere, and it's unique in Tanakh.
But that might be why they were hesitant to accept it as part of the canon, because it's the one.
That's interesting.
Story that's totally out of the box.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's more to be said about that and about Hallel and miracles that happen outside of Israel, but I think I'm looking at the clock and it's 2:14 and we've got a lot to talk about still. So I'm gonna actually move on from this piece of what we're doing in favor of what's coming next. So chapter 10. I like chapter 10. Chapter 10, sentence 1. Vayasem hamelech Achashverosh mas al haaretz v'iye hayam. King Achashverosh placed a tax over the land and the islands of the sea. So, or the shoreland areas. When I lay Megillah often, I didn't do it this year, but often I pause after mas to see who's going to boo. The Achashverosh places a tax over the lands. And then, sentence 2, V'chomasei sokpo uvaraso. All of his power, all of his might, ufarashas gedulas Mordechai, as well as laying out the greatness of Mordechai. All of this is recorded in the chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia. And then the last sentence, for Mordechai was viceroy to King Achashverosh, great for the Jews, beloved to somebody, we have to come back to that, sought good for his nation, and spoke shalom, the welfare or the peace, for all of his descendants. That's the last chapter. Sentence 1, Achashverosh made a tax. Sentence 2, Achashverosh was great and mighty, and he was responsible for Mordechai's power. And sentence 3, Mordechai, viceroy of Achashverosh, is really great. I am confused in this chapter, who is the protagonist? Who's the hero of the chapter? Who's the main figure of the chapter?
Yeah. The
two, Ahasuerus
and Mordechai.
So, Mordechai here, well, first of all, it ain't Esther. She's invisible.
No, it's definitely
right? She's gone. Mordechai, right. Mordechai is here only as a function of Ahasuerus.
So it's definitely
Ahasuerus. It's Ahasuerus. This is the book of Ahasuerus. So what is this chapter doing by mentioning his tax? What is this chapter trying to get across by mentioning Ahasuerus' tax? Yes, Susan, Janine, Bruria, and Moish.
Well, I think they're mentioning his tax because don't think that everything's great for the Jews. Just warning you, it may have changed. They weren't killed, but look here, they were still taxed. They still had. They still weren't accepted.
The tax is on everybody. It's not about us. The tax is everywhere. Yeah, Janine.
Well, I wonder if ultimately the protagonist is Mordechai. It's like you would talk about the power of the president of the United States. The guy that's second in command, it aggrandizes him. This is a man who had power over, was able to tax 127 countries.
Yeah.
And this is the second in command to this man. It makes Mordechai more important.
Could be. Could be. Bruria?
But my thought is about Ahasuerus because I think that everything that happened until now made Ahasuerus very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore he could impose a tax because all of a sudden he had no, everybody saw how powerful he was. And his enemies were gone. He killed Haman, he let the Jews kill him. So he was
right.
In charge. He could do that without opposition.
Right. So I'm going to come back to that idea because I have more to do with that. I like it. There's something else to add to that. Ricky and then Moish.
I would say Ahasuerus takes the credit for whatever Mordechai did, even though it didn't really benefit him, but it did aggrandize him. And by raising taxes, just like Jeanette said, by raising taxes, it shows that he can.
So that's right. There is that element of because he can.
Exercising his power.
Okay. Moish, is this going to be the Sam thing or something else?
No,
okay.
Not at all. I was just kidding. I'm not giving you that.
Okay.
It's very, very simple. But you have to ask yourself, what are taxes for? Here, there, and now, therefore, health, education, welfare, COVID. Those days, the king had to raise money to go to war. What you're seeing here is he's raising taxes from everybody. Because of what you said, I think they won. The classic empire battle between him and Greece, which he will lose, is about to happen.
Mm-hmm. He's raising it for the war with Greece.
Right across the board, everybody.
So the problem is that that by the time you reach this point in his reign, he's already lost that war. In other words, we're years later. That war was fought before this.
This sponsor could have been earlier. This sponsor could refer to something earlier.
Positioning Mordechai as the viceroy? That's hard. I don't know. I'm going to offer you a few ideas, some of which fit with what's been said already. Ibn Ezra, source number 10. V'hizkir zeh kasuv lahodia ki hitzliach b'chol derachav. This text mentions the tax in order to say that he succeeded in all of his ways, Ahasuerus. He has the power to do it, as was said. V'nirasa gvurasau, his might was visible, achar hayos Mordechai lo lemishneh, because Mordechai was his viceroy. So Ibn Ezra looks at the verse in context and says, the point is to say, Ahasuerus could tax everybody, because Mordechai did a good job. That's one approach. Always comes back to the Jews. Maharal offers us two approaches. One in his commentary to Esther, and one in a separate work called Ner Mitzvah. In source number 11, I brought you from his commentary to Esther. He says, "Bishvil ha-ma'aseh gadol she'asah b'haman, hayala Ahasuerus emat ha-malchut." He says, because of what Ahasuerus did to Haman, nobody wants to cross him. He could tax them. That's fine. Because there was this 50 amah gallows that Haman got hung on. And if he's willing to execute the person who was his viceroy, nobody is safe. So therefore, he can do whatever he wants at this point. But look at Maharal in source number 12. He takes a different tack. He says, this is our concluding insight into Ahasuerus's personality. I'm going to read, because there's a lot of text, I'm just going to read the English here. And the Talmud said, this is a reference to Daniel, where he has a vision of four animals, and the beast that represents Persia, of his four beasts, is like a bear. And the Gemara in Kiddushin says, please don't be insulted if anyone here has Persian ancestry. These are the Persians. Why are they compared to a bear? They eat and drink like a bear, they're fleshy like a bear, they're hairy like a bear, and they are restless like a bear. And the Maharal says, meaning, they perpetually seek to swallow up. This is their trait. Thus it is written regarding this empire in Esther, and King Ahasuerush placed a tax on the land and the islands of the sea. What does this come to teach, saying the king placed a tax on the land? Only, it comes to say that this was the strength of Ahasuerush, that he was lacking, and he perpetually sought to fill his desire with wealth. Ahasuerush is always hungry. He always wants more. And that's, I think, a very powerful point. Leave aside the racism about Persians. That's a discussion for another time. The Maharal lived in Prague. Leave that whole piece aside. That's really a different shear. The point is this. Ahasuerus and the Jews start out the book of Esther in similarly insecure positions. Ahasuerus is in fear of disrespect. He is insecure. He may be afraid of his wife's political power, right? We had the whole discussion about the power in the family and Vashti's role and all of that. Ahasuerus is synonymous with insecurity at the start of the Megillah. He's going to issue a big order that everybody in every household, the wives have to listen to the husbands. The Jews are living in their own fear and insecurity. They're living in exile. They don't have any protection. Haman can decide to wipe them out, and they are out of luck. However, in the course of the Megillah, the Jews and Ahasuerus go in very different directions. Ahasuerus becomes increasingly aggressive. If you take a look at source number 13, Dr. Shlomo Reimer, The Emotional Foundations of the Human Personality. I have never read Dr. Reimer's full book. I don't know who he is. I only went looking to find somebody who would support the following contention, and I found him, that emotional insecurity leads to aggression. It's something we can intuit, but it sounds better if your name is Doctor. So that's why I pulled this. The absence of emotional security always tends to spawn hate. The combination of emotional insecurity and hate invariably gives rise to a personality trait in which aggression is practiced for the express purpose of bolstering security. You are insecure, you identify an enemy, and you act aggressively towards the enemy as a way to protect yourself. And that plays out across the book. We began by seeing Ahasuerus as a schemer from the very start, with his parties and looking to get the support of his base and impress everybody, his attempt to subjugate Vashti, his elevation of Haman. Ahasuerus is in fear throughout the book. It's a weakness that Esther took advantage of, right? She manipulated it. We spent all that time on the parties and Haman. Even appointing Mordechai as viceroy fits the description. Mordechai's only credential that we can perceive in the story in the Megillah for becoming viceroy is what? Number one, he saved the king from assassins. And number two, he's related to the queen, who is trusted, right? That's what makes you a viceroy. The fact that he saved your life, I mean, does that make any sense at all? The Megillah is showing us the personality of a king who never gets out of his fear. And it's telling us the same thing with the tax. At the end of the book, Ahasuerus has learned no lessons. Ahasuerus remains the person he was all along. He is taking from everyone in pursuit of satisfying his need for respect and security. That's who he is. Whereas the Jews, we were aggressive also when we had the opportunity, right? Mordechai tells Esther, go to Ahasuerus. Esther hatches a plan, carries it out. But the underpinning of our experience in the book is still Esther telling the Jews to gather, right? Lech knoset kol ha-Yehudim, that everybody should gather and fast and appeal to God. And the result of that different approach is that we may still be in exile at the end of the book. We're still slaves of Ahasuerus at the end of the story. But we're givers, not takers. Because how do we celebrate Purim? Spontaneously, before anyone sends out any scrolls, we said it last week, sending b'shloach manot, sending gifts to others. The contrast, remember, we didn't do this chapter break, chapters 9 and 10, dividing them up. The contrast is the Jews at the end of the story are giving food to others and giving money to others, and Ahasuerus is issuing a tax to collect from everybody else. That's the contrast that you're seeing there. And yes, as Jeanette notes in the chat, we didn't take the spoils. Excellent point as well. We were licensed to do it, and we didn't take it, as we talked about last week. So that's also a piece of it. So I have one more piece that I wanted to mention. I saw your hand, Rebecca, but I had one just very quickly, because you always have to end the Megillah with this point, which is Mordechai is identified as being beloved Lerov Echav, which gets universally translated as not for his many brothers, but instead the majority of his brothers. I gave you a link in source, where did I do it? I gave you a link in number 17. There's a fellow who's been listening to the Shiurim online, and he sent me a link to an article from Chabad about the Rebbe's explanation about Mordechai and some of what we're going to say, but I didn't have time to incorporate it in this. But what is the message of saying Mordechai is beloved to the majority of his brethren? So I brought you three approaches. And again, if we had time, we'd really discuss it, but I want to start Ruth next week. It's really time to do that. So I'm just going to tell you briefly. Number one, the Gemara's view in source number 14, it is a criticism of Mordechai that some members of the Sanhedrin, the high court, left Mordechai. The idea that Mordechai was initially one of them is its own discussion. We talked about it earlier this year. And the idea is that if you look in the book of Ezra, we have two censuses that seem to record the Jews who came with Zerubbabel. One is in Ezra chapter 2, one is in Nehemiah chapter 7. And in the first one, there's a leader named Mordechai in the list, and he's in the second census also, but he moves down the list. And the suggestion of the Gemara in source number 14 is that because Mordechai abandoned the study of Torah full-time, presumably it was full-time, in order to save the Jews from the Persians, therefore some said, you know, Mordechai, you got involved in politics, like you anymore. And there's a lot to be said about that, obviously. I'm just mentioning that. It's a criticism. The second view I'm going to bring in source number 15 is in the Medrash here. It's also Ibn Ezra. And it says, because not everybody's going to like you. Deal with it. That's the way it is. You can't satisfy everybody. And the Medrash says, no one did as much as Mordechai did for everybody else, and yet, most of them. Most of them liked him. Not everybody. It's a jealousy issue. But then you have Don Isaac Abarbanel, and this is such a good ending. Don Isaac Abarbanel says, no, this is a positive read. It's not a negative read. And read this with Abarbanel's biography in mind. He says, I brought it for you in source number 16. I'm just reading my translation. It reported something shocking. The text here. Mordechai was a Jew, and he's a viceroy for King Ahasuerus. And he was great among the Jews. For even though he was viceroy to the king, one would expect he would not be great in the eyes of the Jews. They would always say, yeah, but who is his father? Who is this? Who is he? Mihuzeva Ezehu in the Hebrew, which is great. That his heart should be so full as to become arrogant, this guy Mordechai, Therefore, it said he was great in the eyes of the Jews. In other words, it's not a knock on him that he doesn't have an 100% popularity rating. It's shock that he has a popularity rating at all. He says it will be even stranger for him to be beloved to most of his brethren and that they not envy his power. This is also very much part of the nature of the children of Israel, he says. There's a little Lashon Hara for you. He says, it's part of our nature to be jealous of people when they get power. Therefore, it reported this shocking thing, saying that he was beloved to most of his brethren. Not all, but most. Why? Because he sought good for his nation and sought the welfare of all of his descendants, or the nation's descendants, depending on how you read the sentence. But the idea is that the Megillah is not knocking Mordechai by saying he's beloved to the majority of his brethren. It's saying, wow, he was beloved to the majority of his brethren, even though he was viceroy. They didn't tear him down. They actually came to his support and they honored him. Why? Because of what he did for them. So I like that as a nice positive way to conclude the book of Esther. I gave you review questions for chapters 8 to 10 at the end of the sheet. You could read that and enjoy. Thank you so much for studying Esther with me. I'm going to stay on for questions and discussion a little bit after, but I'm looking forward to starting Ruth next week. The big question which I'm wrestling right now with, and I don't have an answer I like yet, why is the book of Ruth in Ketuvim, in the writings, instead of being in the Nevi'im, in the prophets? It's credited, in that same Gemara that we read before, it's credited to Shmuel, who is a Navi, who is a prophet. So why is it that it's in Ketuvim instead of Nevi'im? And I don't tell me there are different levels of prophecy involved. Yes, that's true. But why? Why does Shmuel write this one way and not like the rest of his writing? So that'll be next week, God willing, will be the book of Ruth. So, read ahead. Okay, I'm going to stick around now for a few minutes to discuss this.
Thank you. I didn't realize you thought I was going to mention it. I also was wondering whether I was going to say that he doesn't seem any more secure because he keeps just turning into the next guy to fight him. He doesn't seem that good, but